Banasura said, O Lord Mahadev, I bow down to you, the spiritual master and controller of the worlds. You are like the heavenly tree that fulfills the desires of those whose desires are unfulfilled. These 1,000 arms you bestowed upon me have become merely a heavy burden. Besides you, I find no one in the three worlds worthy to fight. Eager to fight with the elephants who rule the directions, I went forth, pulverizing mountains with my arms, which were itching for battle. But even those great elephants fled in fear. Hearing this, Lord Shiva became angry and replied, Your flag will be broken, fool, when you have done battle with one who is my equal. That fight will vanquish your conceit. Thus advised, unintelligent Banasura was delighted. The fool then went home to wait for that which Lord Shiva had predicted, the destruction of his prowess. In a dream, Bana's daughter, the maiden Usha, had an amorous encounter with the son of Prajumna, though she had never before seen or heard of her lover. Losing sight of him in her dream, Usha suddenly sat up in the midst of her girlfriends, crying out, Where are you, my lover? She was greatly disturbed and embarrassed. Banasura had a minister named Krumbanda, whose daughter was Chitraleka. A companion of Usha's, she was filled with curiosity, and thus she inquired from her friend, Who are you searching for, O fine-browed one? What is this hankering you're feeling? Until now, O princess, I haven't seen any man take your hand in marriage. Usha said, In my dream I saw a certain man who had a dark blue complexion, lotus eyes, yellow garments, and mighty arms. He was the kind who touches women's hearts. It is that lover I search for. After making me drink the honey of his lips, he has gone elsewhere, and thus he has thrown me, hankering fervently for him, into the ocean of distress. Chitraleka said, I will remove your distress. If he is to be found anywhere in the three worlds, I will bring this future husband of yours who has stolen your heart. Please show me who he is. Saying this, Chitraleka proceeded to draw accurate pictures of various demigods, Gandharvas, Siddhas, Charanas, Pandagas, Daityas, Vidyadharas, Yakshas, and human beings. Among the humans, Chitraleka drew pictures of the Vrishnis, including Shurasen, Anakadundubi, Balaram, and Krishna. When Usha saw the picture of Prajumna, she became bashful, and when she saw Aniruddha's picture, she bent her head down in embarrassment. Smiling, she exclaimed, He's the one! It's him! Chitraleka, endowed with mystic powers, recognized him as Krishna's grandson, Aniruddha. My dear king, she then traveled by the mystic skyway to Dwaraka, the city under Lord Krishna's protection. There she found Prajumna's son, Aniruddha, sleeping upon a fine bed. With her yogic power, she took him away to Shonitapur, where she presented her girlfriend Usha with her beloved. When Usha beheld him, the most beautiful of men, her face lit up with joy. She took the son of Prajumna to her private quarters, which men were forbidden even to see, and there she enjoyed with him. Usha worshipped Aniruddha with faithful service, offering him priceless garments, along with garlands, fragrances, incense, lamps, sitting places, and so on. She also offered him beverages, all types of food, and sweet words. As he thus remained hidden in the young lady's quarters, Aniruddha did not notice the passing of the days, for his senses were captivated by Usha, whose affection for him ever increased. The female guards eventually noticed unmistakable symptoms of romantic involvement in Usha, who, having broken her maiden vow, was being enjoyed by the Yadu hero and showing signs of conjugal happiness. The guards went to Banasura and told him, O king, we have detected in your daughter the kind of improper behavior that spoils the reputation of a young girl's family. We have been carefully watching over her, never leaving our posts, O master, so we cannot understand how this maiden, whom no man can even see, has been corrupted within the palace. Very agitated to hear of his daughter's corruption, Banasura rushed at once to the maiden's quarters. There he saw the pride of the Yadus, Aniruddha. Banasura saw before him Cupid's own son, possessed of unrivaled beauty, with dark blue complexion, yellow garments, lotus eyes, and formidable arms. His face was adorned with effulgent earrings and hair, and also with smiling glances. As he sat opposite his most auspicious lover, playing with her at dice, there hung between his arms a garland of spring jasmines that had been smeared with kumkum powder from her breasts when he had embraced her. Banasura was astonished to see all this. Seeing Banasura enter with many armed guards, Aniruddha raised his iron club and stood resolute, ready to strike anyone who attacked him. He resembled death personified, holding his rod of punishment. As the guards converged on him from all sides, trying to capture him, Aniruddha struck them just as the leader of a pack of boars strikes back at dogs. Hit by his blows, the guards fled the palace, running for their lives with shattered heads, thighs, and arms. But even as Aniruddha was striking down the army of Bana, that powerful son of Bali angrily caught him with the mystic Nagapasha ropes. When Usha heard of Aniruddha's capture, she was overwhelmed with grief and depression. Her eyes filled with tears, and she wept. Chapter 63. Lord Krishna Fights with Banasura. Shukadev Goswami said, "O descendant of Bharat, the relatives of Aniruddha, not seeing him return, continued to lament as the four rainy months passed. After hearing from Narada the news of Aniruddha's deeds and his capture, the Vrishnis, who worshipped Lord Krishna as their personal deity, went to Shonitapur. With Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna in the lead, the chiefs of the Satvata clan, Pradyumna, Satyaki, Gada, Samba, Sarana, Nanda, Upananda, Bhadra, and others, converged with an army of 12 divisions and laid siege to Banasura's capital, completely surrounding the city on all sides. Banasura became filled with anger upon seeing them destroy his city's suburban gardens, ramparts, watchtowers, and gateways, and thus he went out to confront them with an army of equal size. Lord Rudra, accompanied by his son Kartikeya and the Pramatas, came riding on Nandi, his bull carrier, to fight Balaram and Krishna on Bana's behalf. A most astonishing, tumultuous, and hair-raising battle then commenced, with Lord Krishna matched against Lord Shankara and Pradyumna against Kartikeya. Lord Balaram fought with Krumbanda and Kupakarna, Samba with Bana's son, and Satyaki with Bana. Brahma and the other ruling demigods, along with Siddhas, Charanas, and great sages, as well as Gandharvas, Apsaras, and Yakshas, all came in their celestial airplanes to watch. With sharp-pointed arrows discharged from his bow Shanga, Lord Krishna drove away the various followers of Lord Shiva, Bhutas, Pramatas, Guyakas, Dakinis, Yatudhanas, Vetalas, Vinayakas, Pretas, Matas, Pishachas, Kushmandas, and Brahmarakshasas. Lord Shiva, wielder of the trident, shot various weapons at Lord Krishna, wielder of Shanga. But Lord Krishna was not in the least perplexed. He neutralized all these weapons with appropriate counterweapons. Lord Krishna counteracted a Brahmastra with another Brahmastra, a wind weapon with a mountain weapon, a fire weapon with a rain weapon, and Lord Shiva's personal Pashupatastra weapon with his own personal weapon, the Narayanastra. After bewildering Lord Shiva by making him yawn with a yawning weapon, Lord Krishna proceeded to strike down Banasura's army with his sword, club, and arrows. Lord Kartikeya was distressed by the flood of Pradyumna's arrows raining down from all sides, and thus he fled the battlefield on his peacock as blood poured from his limbs. Kumbanda and Kupakarna, tormented by Lord Balaram's club, fell down dead. When the soldiers of these two demons saw that their leaders had been killed, they scattered in all directions. Banasura was furious to see his entire military force being torn apart. Leaving his fight with Satyaki, he charged across the battlefield on his chariot and attacked Lord Krishna. Excited to a frenzy by the fighting, Bana simultaneously pulled taut all the strings of his 500 bows and fixed two arrows on each string. Lord Sri Hari split every one of Banasura's bows simultaneously and also struck down his chariot driver, chariot, and horses. The Lord then sounded his conch shell. Just then, Banasura's mother, Kotara, desiring to save her son's life, appeared before Lord Krishna naked and with her hair undone. Lord Krishna turned his face away to avoid seeing the naked woman, and Banasura, deprived of his chariot, his bow shattered, took the opportunity to flee into his city. After Lord Shiva's followers had been driven away, the Shivadvar, who had three heads and 3 feet, pressed forward to attack Lord Krishna. As the Shivadvar approached, he seemed to burn everything in the 10 directions. Seeing this personified weapon approach, Lord Narayan then released his own personified fever weapon, the Vishnu Dwar. The Shiva Dwar and Vishnu Dwar thus battled each other. The Shiva Dwar, overwhelmed by the strength of the Vishnu Dwar, cried out in pain. But finding no refuge, the frightened Shiva Dwar approached Lord Krishna, the master of the senses, hoping to attain his shelter. Thus, with joined palms, he began to praise the Lord. The Shiva Dwar said, I bow down to you of unlimited potencies, the Supreme Lord, the Supersoul of all beings. You possess pure and complete consciousness and are the cause of cosmic creation, maintenance, and dissolution. Perfectly peaceful, you are the absolute truth to whom the Vedas indirectly refer. Time, fate, karma, the jiva and his propensities, the subtle material elements, the material body, the life air, false ego, the various senses, and the totality of these as reflected in the living being's subtle body, all this constitutes your material illusory energy, maya, an endless cycle like that of seed and plant. I take shelter of you, the negation of this maya. With various intentions, you perform pastimes to maintain the demigods, the saintly persons, and the codes of religion for this world. By these pastimes, you also kill those who stray from the right path and live by violence. Indeed, your present incarnation is meant to relieve the earth's burden. I am tortured by the fierce power of your terrible fever weapon, which is cold yet burning. All embodied souls must suffer as long as they remain bound to material ambitions and thus averse to serving your feet. The Supreme Lord said, O three-headed one, I am pleased with you. May your fear of my fever weapon be dispelled, and may whoever remembers our conversation here have no reason to fear you. Thus addressed, the Maheshwara Dwar bowed down to the infallible Lord and went away. But Banasura then appeared, riding forth on his chariot to fight Lord Krishna. Carrying numerous weapons in his thousand hands, the terribly infuriated demon shot many arrows at Lord Krishna, the carrier of the disc weapon. As Bana continued hurling weapons at him, the Supreme Lord began using his razor-sharp chakra to cut off Banasura's arms as if they were tree branches. Lord Shiva felt compassion for his devotee Banasura, whose arms were being cut off, and thus he approached Lord Krishna and spoke to him as follows. You alone are the absolute truth, the supreme light, the mystery hidden within the verbal manifestation of the absolute. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you, for you are uncontaminated like the sky. The sky is your navel, fire your face, water your semen, and heaven your head. The cardinal directions are your sense of hearing, herbal plants the hairs on your body, and water-bearing clouds the hair on your head. The earth is your foot, the moon your mind, and the sun your vision, while I am your ego. The ocean is your abdomen, Indra your arm, Lord Brahma your intelligence, the progenitor of mankind your genitals, and religion your heart. You are indeed the original Purusha, creator of the worlds. Your current descent into the material realm, O Lord of unrestricted power, is meant for upholding the principles of justice and benefiting the entire universe. We demigods, each depending on your grace and authority, develop the seven planetary systems. You are the original person, one without a second, transcendental and self-manifesting. Uncaused, you are the cause of all, and you are the ultimate controller. You are nonetheless perceived in terms of the transformations of matter effected by your illusory energy, transformations you sanction so that the various material qualities can fully manifest. O Almighty One, just as the sun, though hidden by a cloud, illuminates the cloud and all other visible forms as well, so you, although hidden by the material qualities, remain self-luminous and thus reveal all those qualities, along with the living entities who possess them. Their intelligence bewildered by your maya, fully attached to children, wife, home, and so on. Persons immersed in the ocean of material misery sometimes rise to the surface and sometimes sink down. One who has attained this human form of life as a gift from God, yet who fails to control his senses and honor your feet, is surely to be pitied, for he is only cheating himself. That mortal who rejects you, his true self, dearmost friend and Lord, for the sake of sense objects, whose nature is just the opposite, refuses nectar and instead consumes poison. I, Lord Brahma, the other demigods, and the pure-minded sages have all surrendered wholeheartedly unto you our dear most self and Lord. Let us worship you, the Supreme Lord, to be freed from material life. You are the maintainer of the universe and the cause of its creation and demise. Equipoised and perfectly at peace, you are the true friend, self, and worshipable Lord. You are one without a second, the shelter of all the worlds and all souls. This Banasar is my dear and faithful follower, and I have awarded him freedom from fear. Therefore, my Lord, please grant him your mercy, just as you showed mercy to Prahlad, the Lord of the demons. The Supreme Lord said, My dear Lord Shiva, for your pleasure we must certainly do what you have requested of us. I fully agree with your conclusion. I will not kill this demonic son of Virochini, for I gave Prahlad Maharaj the benediction that I would not kill any of his descendants. It was to subdue Banasura's false pride that I severed his arms, and I slew his mighty army because they had become a burden to the earth. This demon, who still has four arms, will be immune to old age and death, and he will serve as one of your principal attendants. Thus he will have nothing to fear on any account. Thus attaining freedom from fear, Banasura offered obeisances to Lord Krishna by touching his head to the ground. Bana then seated Aniruddha and his bride on their chariot and brought them before the Lord. Lord Krishna then placed Aniruddha and his bride, both beautifully adorned with fine clothes and ornaments, at the front of the party and surrounded them with a full military division. Thus Lord Krishna took his leave of Lord Shiva and departed. The Lord then entered his capital. The city was lavishly decorated with flags and victory arches, and its avenues and crossways were all sprinkled with water. As conch shells, anakas, and dundubi drums resounded, the Lord's relatives, the Brahmins, and the general populace all came forward to greet him respectfully. Whoever rises early in the morning and remembers Lord Krishna's victory in his battle with Lord Shiva will never experience defeat. Chapter 64, The Deliverance of King Riga. Sri Badarayani said, O King, one day Samba, Pradyumna, Charu, Banu, Gada, and other young boys of the Yadu dynasty went to a small forest to play. After playing for a long time, they became thirsty. As they searched for water, they looked inside a dry well and saw a peculiar creature. The boys were astonished to behold this creature, a lizard who looked like a hill. They felt sorry for it and tried to lift it out of the well. They caught on to the trapped lizard with leather thongs and then with woven ropes, but still they could not lift it out. So they went to Lord Krishna and excitedly told him about the creature. The lotus-eyed Supreme Lord, maintainer of the universe, went to the well and saw the lizard. Then with his left hand he easily lifted it out. Touched by the hand of the glorious Supreme Lord, the being at once gave up its lizard form and assumed that of a resident of heaven. His complexion was beautifully colored like molten gold, and he was adorned with wonderful ornaments, clothes, and garlands. Lord Krishna understood the situation, but to inform people in general, he inquired as follows, Who are you, O greatly fortunate one? Seeing your excellent form, I think you must truly be an exalted demigod. By what past activity were you brought to this condition? It seems you did not deserve such a fate, O good soul. We are eager to know about you, so please inform us about yourself, if, that is, you think this the proper time and place to tell us. Shukadeva Goswami said, Thus questioned by Krishna, whose forms are unlimited, the king, his helmet as dazzling as the sun, bowed down to the Lord and replied as follows, I am a king known as Nriga, the son of Ikshvaku. Perhaps, O Lord, you have heard of me when lists of charitable men were recited. What could possibly be unknown to you, O Master? With vision undisturbed by time, you witness the minds of all living beings. Nevertheless, on your order I will speak. I gave in charity as many cows as there are grains of sand on the earth, stars in the heavens, or drops in a rain shower. Young, brown, milk-laden cows, who were well-behaved, beautiful, and endowed with good qualities, who were all acquired honestly, and who had gilded horns, silver-plated hooves, and decorations of fine ornamental cloths and garlands, such were the cows, along with their calves, that I gave in charity. I first honored the Brahmins who were recipients of my charity by decorating them with fine ornaments. Those most exalted Brahmins whose families were in need were young and possessed of excellent character and qualities. They were dedicated to truth, famous for their austerity, vastly learned in the Vedic scriptures, and saintly in their behavior. I gave them cows, land, gold, and houses, along with horses, elephants, and marriageable girls with maidservants, as well as sesame, silver, fine beds, clothing, jewels, furniture, and chariots. In addition, I performed Vedic sacrifices and executed various pious welfare activities. Once a cow belonging to a certain first-class Brahmin wandered away and entered my herd. Unaware of this, I gave that cow in charity to a different Brahmin. When the cow's first owner saw her being led away, he said, "She's mine." The second Brahmin, who had accepted her as a gift, replied, "No, she's mine. Nirga gave her to me." As the two Brahmins argued, each trying to fulfill his own purpose, they came to me. One of them said, "You gave me this cow." And the other said, "But you stole her from me." Hearing this, I was bewildered. Finding myself in a terrible dilemma concerning my duty in the situation, I humbly entreated both the Brahmins. "I will give 100,000 of the best cows in exchange for this one. Please give her back to me. Your good selves should be merciful to me, your servant. I did not know what I was doing. Please save me from this difficult situation, or I'll surely fall into a filthy hell." The present owner of the cow said, "I don't want anything in exchange for this cow, O king," and went away. The other Brahmin declared, "I don't want even 10,000 more cows than you are offering," and he too went away. O Lord of Lords, O Master of the Universe, the agents of Yamaraj, taking advantage of the opportunity thus created, later carried me to his abode. There Yamaraj himself questioned me, "My dear king, do you wish to experience the results of your sins first, or those of your piety? Indeed, I see no end to the dutiful charity you have performed, or to your consequent enjoyment in the radiant heavenly planets." I replied, "First, my lord, let me suffer my sinful reactions." And Yamaraj said, "Then fall." At once I fell, and while falling, I saw myself becoming a lizard, O master. O Keshava, as your servant, I was devoted to the Brahmins and generous to them, and I always hankered for your audience. Therefore, even till now, I have never forgotten my past life. O Almighty One, how is it that my eyes see you here before me? You are the Supreme Soul, whom the greatest masters of mystic yoga can meditate upon within their pure hearts only by employing the spiritual eye of the Vedas. Then how, O Transcendental Lord, are you directly visible to me, since my intelligence has been blinded by the severe tribulations of material life? Only one who has finished his material entanglement in this world should be able to see you. O Deva Deva, Jagannath, Govinda, Purushottama, Narayan, Rishikesh, Punyashloka, Achyuta, Avyaya, O Krishna, please permit me to depart for the world of the demigods. Wherever I live, O Master, may my mind always take shelter of your lotus feet. I offer my repeated obeisances unto you, Krishna, the son of Vasudeva. You are the source of all beings, the supreme absolute truth, the possessor of unlimited potencies, the master of all spiritual disciplines. Having spoken thus, Maharaj Nriga circumambulated Lord Krishna and touched his crown to the Lord's feet. Granted permission to depart, King Nriga then boarded a wonderful celestial airplane as all the people present looked on. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, the son of Devaki, who is especially devoted to the Brahmins and who embodies the essence of religion, then spoke to his personal associates and thus instructed the royal class in general. Lord Krishna said, "How indigestible is the property of a Brahmin, even when enjoyed just slightly and by one more potent than fire? What then to speak of kings who try to enjoy it, presuming themselves lords? I do not consider hala hala to be real poison, because it has an antidote. But a Brahmin's property, when stolen, can truly be called poison, for it has no antidote in this world. Poison kills only the person who ingests it, and an ordinary fire may be extinguished with water. But the fire generated from the kindling wood of a Brahmin's property burns the thief's entire family down to the root. If a person enjoys a Brahmin's property without receiving due permission, that property destroys 3 generations of his family. But if he takes it by force or gets the government or other outsiders to help him usurp it, then 10 generations of his ancestors and 10 generations of his descendants are all destroyed. Members of the royal order, blinded by royal opulence, fail to foresee their own downfall. Childishly hankering to enjoy a Brahmin's property, they are actually hankering to go to hell. For as many years as there are particles of dust touched by the tears of generous Brahmins who have dependent families and whose property is stolen, uncontrolled kings who usurp a Brahmin's property are cooked, along with their royal families, in the hell known as Kumbhi Paka. Whether it be his own gift or someone else's, a person who steals a Brahmin's property will take birth as a worm in feces for 60,000 years. I do not desire Brahmin's wealth. Those who lust after it become short-lived and are defeated. They lose their kingdoms and become snakes who trouble others. My dear followers, never treat a learned Brahmin harshly, even if he has sinned. Even if he attacks you physically or repeatedly curses you, always continue to offer him obeisances. Just as I always carefully bow down to Brahmins, so all of you should likewise bow down to them. I will punish anyone who acts otherwise. When a Brahmin's property is stolen, even unknowingly, it certainly causes the person who takes it to fall down, just as the Brahmin's cow did to Nirga. Having thus instructed the residents of Dwarka, Lord Mukunda, purifier of all the worlds, entered his palace. Chapter 65, Lord Balaram Visits Vrindavan. Shukadev Goswami said, O best of the Kurus, once Lord Balaram, eager to visit his well-wishing friends, mounted his chariot and traveled to Nanda Gokula. Having long suffered the anxiety of separation, the cowherd men and their wives embraced Lord Balaram. The Lord then offered respects to his parents, and they joyfully greeted him with prayers. Nanda and Yashoda prayed, O descendant of the Sharha, O Lord of the universe, may you and your younger brother Krishna ever protect us. Saying this, they raised Sri Balaram onto their laps, embraced him, and moistened him with tears from their eyes. Lord Balaram then paid proper respects to the elder cowherd men, and the younger ones all greeted him respectfully. He met them all with smiles, handshakes, and so on, dealing personally with each one according to age, degree of friendship, and family relationship. Then, after resting, the Lord accepted a comfortable seat, and they all gathered around him. With voices faltering out of love for him, those cowherds, who had dedicated everything to lotus-eyed Krishna, asked him about the health of their dear ones in Dwarka, and Balaram in turn asked about the cowherd's welfare. The cowherd said, O Rama, are all our relatives doing well? And Rama, do all of you with your wives and children still remember us? It is our great fortune that sinful Kamsa has been killed and our dear relatives freed. And it is also our good fortune that our relatives have killed and defeated their enemies and found complete security in a great fortress. Shukadev Goswami continued, Honored to have the personal audience of Lord Balaram, the young gopi smiled and asked him, Is Krishna, the darling of the city women, living happily? Does he remember his family members, especially his father and mother? Do you think he will ever come back even once to see his mother? And does mighty-armed Krishna remember the service we always did for him? For Krishna's sake, we abandoned our mothers, fathers, brothers, husbands, children, and sisters, even though these family relations are difficult to give up. But now, O Lord, that same Krishna has suddenly abandoned us and gone away, breaking off all affectionate ties with us. And yet how could any woman fail to trust his promises? How can intelligent city women possibly trust the words of one whose heart is so unsteady and who is so ungrateful? They must believe him because he speaks so wonderfully, and also because his beautiful smiling glances arouse their lust. Why bother talking about him, dear gopis? Please talk of something else. If he passes his time without us, then we shall similarly pass ours without him. While speaking these words, the young cowherd women remembered Lord Krishna's laughter, his pleasing conversations with them, his attractive glances, his style of walking, and his loving embraces. Thus they began to cry. Lord Balaram, the attractor of all, being expert at various kinds of conciliation, consoled the gopis by relaying to them the confidential messages Lord Krishna had sent with him. These messages deeply touched the gopis' hearts. Lord Balaram, the personality of Godhead, resided there for the 2 months of Madhu and Madhava, and during the nights he gave his cowherd girlfriends conjugal pleasure. In the company of numerous women, Lord Balaram enjoyed in a garden by the Yamuna River. This garden was bathed in the rays of the full moon and caressed by breezes bearing the fragrance of night-blooming lotuses. Sent by the demigod Varuna, the divine Varuni liquor flowed from a tree hollow and made the entire forest even more fragrant with its sweet aroma. The wind carried to Balaram the fragrance of that flood of sweet liquor, and when he smelled it, he went to the tree. There he and his female companions drank. As the Gandharvas sang his glories, Lord Balaram enjoyed within the brilliant circle of young women. He appeared just like Indra's elephant, the lordly Airavata, enjoying in the company of she-elephants. At that time, kettle drums resounded in the sky, the Gandharvas joyfully rained down flowers, and the great sages praised Lord Balaram's heroic deeds. As his deeds were sung, Lord Balaram wandered as if inebriated among the various forests with his girlfriends. His eyes rolled from the effects of the liquor. Intoxicated with joy, Lord Balaram sported flower garlands, including the famous Vaijayanti. He wore a single earring, and beads of perspiration decorated his smiling lotus face like snowflakes. The Lord then summoned the Yamuna River so that he could play in her waters, but she disregarded his command, thinking he was drunk. This angered Balaram, and he began dragging the river with the tip of his plow. Lord Balaram said, "O sinful one disrespecting me, you do not come when I call you, but rather move only by your own whim. Therefore, with the tip of my plow, I shall bring you here in 100 streams. Shukadev Goswami continued, "Thus scolded by the Lord, the frightened river goddess Yamuna came and fell at the feet of Sri Balaram, the beloved descendant of Yadu. Trembling, she spoke to him the following words, "Rama, Rama, almighty armed one, I know nothing of your prowess. With a single portion of yourself, you hold up the earth, O Lord of the universe. My Lord, please release me. O soul of the universe, I didn't understand your position as the supreme Godhead, but now I have surrendered unto you, and you are always kind to your devotees." Thereupon, Lord Balaram released the Yamuna, and like the king of the elephants with his entourage of she-elephants, he entered the river's water with his female companions. The Lord played in the water to his full satisfaction, and when he came out, Goddess Kanti presented him with blue garments, precious ornaments, and a brilliant necklace. Lord Balaram dressed himself in the blue garments and put on the gold necklace. Anointed with fragrances and beautifully adorned, he appeared as resplendent as Indra's royal elephant. Even today, one can see how the Yamuna flows through the many channels created when it was dragged by the unlimitedly powerful Lord Balaram. Thus, she demonstrates his prowess. For Lord Balaram, all the nights passed like a single night as he enjoyed in Braja, his mind enchanted by the exquisite charm and beauty of Braja's young ladies. Chapter 66, Poundrika, the False Vasudev. Shukadev Goswami said, "O King, while Lord Balaram was away visiting Nanda's village of Braja, the ruler of Karusha, foolishly thinking, 'I am the Supreme Lord, Vasudev,' sent a messenger to Lord Krishna. Poundrika was emboldened by the flattery of childish men who told him, 'You are Vasudev, the Supreme Lord and Master of the universe, who have now descended to the earth.' Thus he imagined himself to be the infallible personality of Godhead. Slow-witted King Poundrika sent a messenger to the inscrutable Lord Krishna at Dwaraka. Poundrika was acting just like an unintelligent child whom other children are pretending is a king. Arriving in Dwaraka, the messenger found lotus-eyed Krishna in his royal assembly and relayed the king's message to that almighty Lord. On Poundrika's behalf, the messenger said, 'I am the one and only Lord Vasudev, and there is no other. It is I who have descended to this world to show mercy to the living beings. Therefore, give up your false name. O Satvata, give up my personal symbols, which out of foolishness you now carry, and come to me for shelter. If you do not, then you must give me battle.' King Ugrasen and the other members of the assembly laughed loudly when they heard this vain boasting of unintelligent Poundrika. the personality of Godhead, after enjoying the jokes of the assembly, told the messenger to relay a message to his master. "You fool, I will indeed let loose the weapons you boast of in this way. When you lie dead, O fool, your face covered by vultures, herons, and vata birds, you will become the shelter of dogs." When the Lord had thus spoken, the messenger conveyed his insulting reply to his master in its entirety. Lord Krishna then mounted his chariot and went to the vicinity of Kashi. Upon observing Lord Krishna's preparations for battle, the mighty warrior Poundrika quickly went out of the city with two full military divisions. Poundrika's friend, the king of Kashi, followed behind, leading the rear guard with three Akshauhini divisions. Lord Krishna saw that Poundrika was carrying the Lord's own insignia, such as the conch shell, disc, sword, and club, and also an imitation Shanga bow and Shivat's mark. He wore a mock Kaustubha gem, was decorated with a garland of forest flowers, and was dressed in upper and lower garments of fine yellow silk. His banner bore the image of Garuda, and he wore a valuable crown and gleaming shark-shaped earrings. Lord Hari laughed heartily when he saw how the king had dressed up in exact imitation of his own appearance, just like an actor on a stage. The enemies of Lord Hari attacked him with tridents, clubs, bludgeons, pikes, rishtis, barbed darts, lances, swords, axes, and arrows. But Lord Krishna fiercely struck back at the army of Poundrika and Kashiraj, which consisted of elephants, chariots, cavalry, and infantry. The Lord tormented his enemies with his club, sword, Sudarshan disc, and arrows, just as the fire of annihilation torments the various kinds of creatures at the end of a cosmic age. The battlefield, strewn with the dismembered chariots, horses, elephants, humans, mules, and camels that had been cut to pieces by the Lord's disc weapon, shone like the gruesome playground of Lord Bhutapati, giving pleasure to the wise. Lord Krishna then addressed Poundrika. "My dear Poundrika, the very weapons you spoke of through your messenger, I now release unto you. O fool, now I shall make you renounce my name, which you have falsely assumed, and I will certainly take shelter of you if I do not wish to fight you." Having thus derided Poundrika, Lord Krishna destroyed his chariot with his sharp arrows. The Lord then cut off his head with the Sudarshan disc, just as Lord Indra lops off a mountain peak with his thunderbolt weapon. With his arrows, Lord Krishna similarly severed Kashiraj's head from his body, sending it flying into Kashi like a lotus flower thrown by the wind. Having thus killed envious Poundrika and his ally, Lord Krishna returned to Dwaraka. As he entered the city, the Siddhas of heaven chanted his immortal nectarian glories. By constantly meditating upon the Supreme Lord, Poundrika shattered all his material bonds. Indeed, by imitating Lord Krishna's appearance, he ultimately became Krishna conscious. Seeing a head decorated with earrings lying at the gate of the royal palace, the people present were puzzled. Some of them asked, "What is this?" And others said, "It is a head, but whose is it?" When they recognized it as the head of their king, the Lord of Kashi, his queens, sons, and other relatives, along with all the citizens of the city, began to cry pitifully, "Alas, we are killed! Oh, my lord, my lord!" After the king's son Sudakshina had performed the obligatory funeral rituals for his father, he resolved within his mind, "Only by killing my father's murderer can I avenge his death." Thus the charitable Sudakshin, together with his priests, began worshipping Lord Shiva with great attention. Satisfied by the worship, the powerful Lord Shiva appeared in the sacred precinct of Avimukta and offered Sudakshin his choice of benedictions. The prince chose as his benediction a means to slay his father's killer. Lord Shiva told him, "Accompanied by Brahmins, serve the Dakshinagni fire, the original priest, following the injunctions of the Abhichara ritual. Then the Dakshinagni fire, together with many pramatas, will fulfill your desire if you direct it against someone inimical to the Brahmins." So instructed, Sudakshin strictly observed the ritualistic vows and invoked the Abhichara against Lord Krishna. Thereupon, the fire rose up out of the altar pit, assuming the form of an extremely fearsome naked person. The fiery creature's beard and tuft of hair were like molten copper, and his eyes emitted blazing hot cinders. His face looked most frightful with its fangs and terrible arched and furrowed brows. As he licked the corners of his mouth with his tongue, the demon shook his flaming trident. On legs as tall as palm trees, the monster raced toward Dwaraka in the company of ghostly spirits, shaking the ground and burning the world in all directions. Seeing the approach of the fiery demon created by the Abhichara ritual, the residents of Dwaraka were all struck with fear, like animals terrified by a forest fire. Distraught, the people cried out to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who was then playing at dice in the royal court. "Save us! Save us, O Lord of the Three Worlds, from this fire burning up the city!" When Lord Krishna heard the people's agitation and saw that even his own men were disturbed, that most worthy giver of shelter simply laughed and told them, "Do not fear, I shall protect you." The Almighty Lord, the internal and external witness of all, understood that the monster had been produced by Lord Shiva from the sacrificial fire. To defeat the demon, Krishna dispatched his disc weapon, who was waiting at his side. The Sudarshan Chakra blazed forth like millions of suns. His effulgence blazed like the fire of universal annihilation, and with his heat he pained the sky, all the directions, heaven and earth, and also the fiery demon. Frustrated by the power of Lord Krishna's weapon, the fiery creature produced by black magic turned his face away and retreated. Created for violence, the demon then returned to Kashi, where he surrounded the city and then burned Sudakshina and his priests to death, even though Sudakshina was his creator. Lord Vishnu's disc also entered Kashi in pursuit of the fiery demon and proceeded to burn the city to the ground, including all its assembly halls and residential palaces with raised porches, its numerous marketplaces, gateways, watchtowers, warehouses, and treasuries, and all the buildings housing elephants, horses, chariots, and grains. After burning down the entire city of Kashi, Lord Vishnu's Sudarshan Chakra returned to the side of Sri Krishna, whose actions are effortless. Any mortal who recounts this heroic pastime of Lord Krishna's, or who simply hears it attentively, will become freed from all sins. Chapter 67, Lord Balaram Slays Dravida Gorilla. The glorious King Parikshit said, "I wish to hear further about Sri Balaram, the unlimited and immeasurable Supreme Lord, whose activities are all astounding. What else did he do?" Sri Shukadev Goswami said, "There was an ape named Dravida who was a friend of Narakasura's. This powerful Dravida, the brother of Mainda, had been instructed by King Sugriva. To avenge the death of his friend Naraka, the ape Dravida ravaged the land, setting fires that burned cities, villages, mines, and cowherd dwellings. Once Dravida tore up a number of mountains and used them to devastate all the neighboring kingdoms, especially the province of Anarta, wherein dwelt his friend's killer, Lord Hari. Another time he entered the ocean, and with the strength of 10,000 elephants, he churned up its water with his arms and thus submerged the coastal regions. The wicked ape tore down the trees in the hermitages of exalted sages and contaminated their sacrificial fires with his feces and urine. Just as a wasp imprisons smaller insects, he arrogantly threw both men and women into caves in a mountain valley and sealed the caves shut with boulders. Once, while Dravida was thus engaged in harassing the neighboring kingdoms and polluting women of respectable families, he heard very sweet singing coming from Rivataka Mountain. So he went there. There he saw Sri Balaram, the Lord of the Yadus, adorned with a garland of lotuses and appearing most attractive in every limb. He was singing amidst a crowd of young women, and since he had drunk Varuni liquor, his eyes rolled as if he were intoxicated. His body shone brilliantly as he behaved like an elephant in rut. The mischievous ape climbed the tree branch and then revealed his presence by shaking the trees and making the sound, "Kila, kila!" When Lord Baladev's consorts saw the ape's impudence, they began to laugh. After all, they were young girls who were fond of joking and prone to silliness. Even as Lord Balaram looked on, Dravida insulted the girls by making odd gestures with his eyebrows, coming right in front of them and showing them his anus. Angered, Lord Balaram, the best of fighters, hurled a rock at him, but the cunning ape dodged the rock and grabbed the Lord's pot of liquor. Further infuriating Lord Balaram by laughing and by ridiculing him, wicked Dravida then broke the pot and offended the Lord even more by pulling at the girl's clothing. Thus the powerful ape, puffed up with false pride, continued to insult Sri Balaram. Lord Balaram saw the ape's rude behavior and thought of the disruptions he had created in the surrounding kingdoms. Thus the Lord angrily took up his club and his plow weapon, having decided to put his enemy to death. Mighty Dravida also came forward to do battle. Uprooting a shala tree with one hand, he rushed toward Balaram and struck him on the head with the tree trunk. But Lord Balaram remained as motionless as a mountain and simply grabbed the log as it fell upon his head. He then struck Dravida with his club, named Sunanda. Struck on the skull by the Lord's club, Dravida became brilliantly decorated by the outpour of blood, like a mountain beautified by red oxide. Ignoring the wound, Dravida uprooted another tree, stripped it of leaves by brute force, and struck the Lord again. Now enraged, Lord Balaram shattered the tree into hundreds of pieces, upon which Dravida grabbed yet another tree and furiously hit the Lord again. This tree, too, the Lord smashed into hundreds of pieces. Thus fighting the Lord, who again and again demolished the trees he was attacked with, Dravida kept on uprooting trees from all sides until the forest was left treeless. The angry ape then released a rain of stones upon Lord Balaram, but the wielder of the club easily pulverized them all. Dravida, the most powerful of apes, now clenched his fists at the end of his palm tree-sized arms, came before Lord Balaram, and beat his fists against the Lord's body. The furious Lord of the Yadavas then threw aside his club and plow, and with his bare hands hammered a blow upon Dravida's collarbone. The ape collapsed, vomiting blood. When he fell, Rivataka Mountain shook, along with its cliffs and trees, like a wind-tossed boat at sea. In the heavens, the demigods, perfect mystics, and great sages cried out, "Victory to you! Obeisances to you! Excellent! Well done!" and showered flowers upon the Lord. Having thus killed Dravida, who had disturbed the whole world, the Supreme Lord returned to his capital as the people along the way chanted his glories. Chapter 68, The Marriage of Samba. Shukadeva Goswami said, "O King, Jambavati's son Samba, ever victorious in battle, kidnapped Duryodhana's daughter Lakshmana from her Swayamvara ceremony." The angry Kuru said, "This ill-behaved boy has offended us, forcibly kidnapping our unmarried daughter against her will. Arrest this ill-behaved Samba. What will the Vrishnis do? By our grace, they are ruling land that we have granted them. If the Vrishnis come here when they learn that their son has been captured, we will break their pride. Thus they'll become subdued, like bodily senses brought under strict control." After saying this and having their plan sanctioned by the senior member of the Kuru dynasty, Karna, Shala, Buri, Yajnaketu, and Suyodhana set out to attack Samba. Seeing Duryodhana and his companions rushing toward him, Samba, the great chariot fighter, took up his splendid bow and stood alone like a lion. Determined to capture him, the angry bowmen led by Karna shouted at Samba, "Stand and fight! Stand and fight!" They came straight for him and showered him with arrows. O best of the Kurus, as Karna's son Samba was being unjustly harassed by the Kurus, that darling of the Yadu dynasty did not tolerate their attack, any more than a lion would tolerate an attack by puny animals. Twanging his wonderful bow, heroic Samba struck with arrows the six warriors headed by Karna. He pierced the six chariots with as many arrows, each team of four horses with four arrows, and each chariot driver with a single arrow, and he similarly struck the great bowmen who commanded the chariots. The enemy warriors congratulated Samba for this display of prowess. But they forced him down from his chariot, and thereupon four of them struck his four horses, one of them struck down his chariot driver, and another broke his bow. Having deprived Samba of his chariot during the fight, the Kuru warriors tied him up with great difficulty, and then returned victorious to their city, taking the young boy and their princess. When the Yadavas heard news of this from Sri Narada, they became angry. Urged on by King Ugrasen, they prepared for war against the Kurus. Lord Balaram, however, cooled the tempers of the Vrishni heroes, who had already put on their armor. He who purifies the age of quarrel did not want a quarrel between the Kurus and the Vrishnis. Thus, accompanied by Brahmins and family elders, he went to Hastinapur on his chariot, which was as effulgent as the sun. As he went, he appeared like the moon surrounded by the ruling planets. Upon arriving at Hastinapur, Lord Balaram remained in a garden outside the city and sent Uddhava ahead to probe King Dhritarashtra's intentions. After he had offered proper respects to Dhritarashtra and to Bhishma, Drona, Bahlika, and Duryodhana, Uddhava informed them that Lord Balaram had arrived. Overjoyed to hear that Balaram, their dearmost friend, had come, they first honored Uddhava and then went forth to meet the Lord, carrying auspicious offerings in their hands. They approached Lord Balaram and worshipped him with gifts of cows and argya, as was fitting. Those among the Kurus who understood his true power bowed down to him, touching their heads to the ground. After both parties had heard that their relatives were doing well, and both had inquired into each other's welfare and health, Lord Balaram forthrightly spoke to the Kurus as follows. King Ugrasen is our master and the ruler of kings. With undivided attention, you should hear what he has ordered you to do, and then you should do it at once. King Ugrasen has said, even though by irreligious means several of you defeated a single opponent who follows the religious codes, still I am tolerating this for the sake of unity among family members. Upon hearing these words of Lord Baladev's, which were full of potency, courage, and strength, and were appropriate to his transcendental power, the Kauravas became furious and spoke as follows. Oh, how amazing this is! The force of time is indeed insurmountable. A lowly shoe now wants to climb on the head that bears the royal crown. It is because these Vrishnis are bound to us by marital ties that we have granted them equality, allowing them to share our beds, seats, and meals. Indeed, it is we who have given them their royal thrones. Only because we looked the other way could they enjoy the pair of yak-tail fans and the conch shell, white umbrella, throne, and royal bed. No longer should the Yadavs be allowed to use these royal symbols, which now cause trouble for those who gave them, like milk fed to poisonous snakes. Having prospered by our grace, these Yadavas have now lost all shame and are daring to command us. How would even Indra dare usurp anything that Bhishma, Drona, Arjuna, or the other Kurus have not given him? It would be like a lamb claiming the lion's kill. Sri Bhadarayani said, O best of the Bharatas, after the arrogant Kurus, thoroughly puffed up by the opulence of their high birth and relations, had spoken these harsh words to Balaram, they turned and went back to their city. Seeing the bad character of the Kurus and hearing their nasty words, the infallible Lord Balaram became filled with rage. His countenance frightful to behold, he laughed repeatedly and spoke as follows. Clearly, the many passions of these scoundrels have made them so proud that they do not want peace. Then let them be pacified by physical punishment, as animals are with a stick. Ah, only gradually was I able to calm the furious Yadus and Lord Krishna, who was also enraged. Desiring peace for these Kauravas, I came here. But they are so dull-headed, fond of quarrel, and mischievous by nature, that they have repeatedly disrespected me. Out of conceit, they dare to address me with harsh words. King Ugrasen, the lord of the Bhojas, Vrishnis, and Andakas, is not fit to command when Indra and other planetary rulers obey his orders. That same Krishna who occupies the Sudharma assembly hall and for his enjoyment took the Parijata tree from the immortal demigods, that very Krishna is indeed not fit to sit on a royal throne. The goddess of fortune herself, ruler of the entire universe, worships his feet. And the master of the goddess of fortune does not deserve the paraphernalia of a mortal king. The dust of Krishna's lotus feet, which is the source of holiness for all places of pilgrimage, is worshipped by all the great demigods. The principal deities of all planets are engaged in his service, and they consider themselves most fortunate to take the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna on their crowns. Great demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, and even the goddess of fortune and I, are simply parts of his spiritual identity, and we also carefully carry that dust on our heads. And still, Krishna is not fit to use the royal insignia or even sit on the royal throne? We Vrishnis enjoy only whatever small parcel of land the Kurus allow us, and we are indeed shoes, whereas the Kurus are the head? Just see how these puffed-up Kurus are intoxicated with their so-called power, like ordinary drunken men. What actual ruler with the power to command would tolerate their foolish, nasty words? Today I shall rid the earth of the Kauravas, declared the furious Balaram. Thus he took his plow weapon and rose up as if to set the three worlds ablaze. The Lord angrily dug up Hastinapur with the tip of his plow and began to drag it, intending to cast the entire city into the Ganges. Seeing that their city was tumbling about like a raft at sea as it was being dragged away, and that it was about to fall into the Ganges, the Kauravas became terrified. To save their lives, they approached the Lord for shelter, taking their families with them. Placing Samba and Lakshmana in front, they joined their palms in supplication. The Kauravas said, "O Rama, Rama, foundation of everything, we know nothing of your power. Please excuse our offense, for we are ignorant and misguided. You alone cause the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of the cosmos, and of you there is no prior cause. Indeed, O Lord, authorities say that the worlds are mere playthings for you as you perform your pastimes. O unlimited one of a thousand heads, as your pastime you carry this earthly globe upon one of your heads. At the time of annihilation you withdraw the entire universe within your body, and remaining all alone, lie down to rest. Your anger is meant for instructing everyone. It is not a manifestation of hatred or envy. O Supreme Lord, you sustain the pure mode of goodness, and you become angry only to maintain and protect this world. We bow down to you, O soul of all beings, O wielder of all potencies, O tireless maker of the universe. Offering you obeisances, we take shelter of you." Shukadev Goswami said, "Thus propitiated by the Kurus, whose city was trembling and who were surrendering to him in great distress, Lord Balaram became very calm and kindly disposed toward them. 'Do not be afraid,' he said, and took away their fear. Duryodhana, being very affectionate to his daughter, gave as her dowry 1,260-year-old elephants, 120,000 horses, 6,000 golden chariots shining like the sun, and 1,000 maidservants with jeweled lockets on their necks. The Supreme Lord, chief of the Yadavas, accepted all these gifts and then departed with his son and daughter-in-law as his well-wishers bid him farewell. Then Lord Balaram entered Dwaraka and met his relatives, whose hearts were all bound to him in loving attachment. In the assembly hall, he reported to the Yadu leaders everything about his dealings with the Kurus. Even today, the city of Hastinapur is visibly elevated on its southern side along the Ganges, thus showing the signs of Lord Balaram's prowess." Chapter 69, Narada Muni visits Lord Krishna's palaces in Dwaraka. Shukadev Goswami said, "Hearing that Lord Krishna had killed Narakasura and had alone married many brides, Narada Muni desired to see the Lord in this situation. He thought, 'It is quite amazing that in a single body Lord Krishna simultaneously married 16,000 women, each in a separate palace.' Thus the sage of the demigods eagerly went to Dwaraka. The city was filled with the sounds of birds and bees flying about the parks and pleasure gardens, while its lakes, crowded with blooming Indivara, Ambuja, Kalhara, Kumuda, and Utpala lotuses, resounded with the calls of swans and cranes. Dwaraka boasted 900,000 royal palaces, all constructed with crystal and silver and splendorously decorated with huge emeralds. Inside these palaces, the furnishings were bedecked with gold and jewels. Traffic moved along a well-laid-out system of boulevards, roads, intersections, and marketplaces, and many assembly houses and temples of demigods graced the charming city. The roads, courtyards, commercial streets, and residential patios were all sprinkled with water and shaded from the sun's heat by banners waving from flagpoles. In the city of Dwaraka was a beautiful private quarter worshipped by the planetary rulers. This district, where the demigod Vishvakarma had shown all his divine skill, was the residential area of Lord Hari, and thus it was gorgeously decorated by the 16,000 palaces of Lord Krishna's queens. Narada Muni entered one of these immense palaces. Supporting the palace were coral pillars decoratively inlaid with Vaidurya gems. Sapphires bedecked the walls, and the floors glowed with perpetual brilliance. In that palace, Trashta had arranged canopies with hanging strands of pearls. There were also seats and beds fashioned of ivory and precious jewels. In attendance were many well-dressed maidservants bearing lockets on their necks, and also armor-clad guards with turbans, fine uniforms, and jeweled earrings. The glow of numerous jewel-studded lamps dispelled all darkness in the palace. My dear king, on the ornate ridges of the roof danced loudly crying peacocks, who saw the fragrant aguru incense escaping through the holes of the latticed windows and mistook it for a cloud. In that palace, the learned Brahmin saw the lord of the Satvatas, Sri Krishna, together with his wife, who fanned him with a gold-handled yak-tail fan. She personally served him in this way, even though she was constantly attended by 1,000 maidservants equal to her in personal character, beauty, youth, and fine dress. The Supreme Lord is the greatest upholder of religious principles. Thus, when he noticed Narada, he rose at once from Goddess Sri's bed, bowed his crowned head at Narada's feet, and, joining his palms, had the sage sit in his own seat. The Lord bathed Narada's feet and then put the water on his own head. Although Lord Krishna is the supreme spiritual authority of the universe and the master of his devotees, it was proper for him to behave in this way, for his name is Brahmanyadev, the Lord who favors the Brahmins. Thus Sri Krishna honored the sage Narada by bathing his feet, even though the water that bathes the Lord's own feet becomes the Ganges, the ultimate holy shrine. After fully worshipping the great sage of the demigods according to Vedic injunctions, Lord Krishna, who is himself the original sage, Narayan, the friend of Nara, conversed with Narada, and the Lord's measured speech was as sweet as nectar. Finally, the Lord asked Narada, "What may we do for you, our Lord and Master?" Sri Narada said, "O Almighty Lord, it is no surprise that you, the ruler of all worlds, show friendship for all people and yet subdue the envious. As we well know, you descend by your sweet will in order to bestow the highest good on this universe by maintaining and protecting it. Thus your glories are widely sung. Now I have seen your feet, which grant liberation to your devotees, which even Lord Brahma and other great personalities of unfathomable intelligence can only meditate upon within their hearts, and which those who have fallen into the well of material existence resort to for deliverance. Please favor me so that I may constantly think of you as I travel about. Please grant me the power to remember you." Narada then entered the palace of another of Lord Krishna's wives. He was eager to witness the spiritual potency possessed by the master of all masters of mystic power. There he saw the Lord playing at dice with his beloved consort and his friend Uddhava. Lord Krishna worshipped Narada by standing up, offering him a seat, and so on. And then, as if he did not know, asked him, "When did you arrive? What can needy persons like us do for those who are full in themselves? In any case, my dear Brahmin, please make my life auspicious." Thus addressed, Narada was astonished. He simply stood up silently and went to another palace. This time, Naradaji saw that Lord Krishna was engaged as an affectionate father petting his small children. From there, he entered another palace and saw Lord Krishna preparing to take his bath. In one place, the Lord was offering oblations into the sacrificial fires. In another, worshipping through the 5 Mahajagyas. In another, feeding Brahmins. And in yet another, eating the remnants of food left by Brahmins. Somewhere, Lord Krishna was observing the rituals for worship at sunset by refraining from speech and quietly chanting the Gayatri Mantra. And elsewhere, he was moving about with sword and shield in the areas set aside for sword practice. In one place, Lord Krishna was riding on horses, elephants, and chariots, and in another place he was resting on his bed while bards recited his glories. Somewhere he was consulting with royal ministers like Uddhava, and somewhere else he was enjoying in the water, surrounded by many society girls and other young women. Somewhere he was giving well-decorated cows to exalted Brahmins, and elsewhere he was listening to the auspicious narration of epic histories and Puranas. Somewhere, Lord Krishna was found enjoying the company of a particular wife by exchanging joking words with her. Somewhere else, he was found engaged, along with his wife, in religious ritualistic functions. Somewhere, Krishna was found engaged in matters of economic development. And somewhere else, he was found enjoying family life according to the regulative principles of the Shastras. Somewhere, he was sitting alone, meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to material nature. And somewhere he was rendering menial service to his elders, offering them desirable things and reverential worship. In one place, he was planning battles in consultation with some of his advisors, and in another place, he was making peace. Somewhere, Lord Keshava and Lord Balaram were together, pondering the welfare of the pious. Narada saw Lord Krishna engaged in getting his sons and daughters married to suitable brides and bridegrooms at the appropriate time, and the marriage ceremonies were being performed with great pomp. Narada observed how Sri Krishna, the master of all yoga masters, arranged to send away his daughters and sons-in-law, and also to receive them home again at the time of great holiday celebrations. All the citizens were astonished to see these celebrations. Somewhere, Krishna was worshipping all the demigods with elaborate sacrifices, and elsewhere he was fulfilling his religious obligations by doing public welfare work, such as the construction of wells, public parks, and monasteries. In another place, he was on a hunting expedition. Mounted on his Sindhi horse and accompanied by the most heroic of the Yadus, he was killing animals meant for offering in sacrifice. Somewhere, Krishna, the Lord of mystic power, was moving about in disguise among the homes of ministers and other citizens in order to understand what each of them was thinking. Having thus seen this display of the Lord's yoga maya, Narada mildly laughed and then addressed Lord Rishikesh, who was adopting the behavior of a human being. Now we understand your mystic potencies, which are difficult to comprehend even for great mystics, O Supreme Soul, Master of all mystic power. Only by serving your feet have I been able to perceive your powers. O Lord, please give me your leave. I will wander about the worlds which are flooded with your name, loudly singing about your pastimes, which purify the universe. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O Brahman, I am the speaker of religion, its performer and sanctioner. I observe religious principles to teach them to the world, my child, so do not be disturbed. Shukadeva Goswami said, thus in every palace Narada saw the Lord in his same personal form, executing the transcendental principles of religion that purify those engaged in household affairs. Having repeatedly seen the vast mystic display of Lord Krishna, whose power is unlimited, the sage was amazed and filled with wonder. Lord Krishna greatly honored Narada, faithfully presenting him with gifts related to economic prosperity, sense gratification, and religious duties. Thus, fully satisfied, the sage departed, constantly remembering the Lord. In this way, Lord Narayan imitated the ways of ordinary humans, manifesting his divine potencies for the benefit of all beings. Thus he enjoyed, dear King, in the company of his 16,000 exalted consorts, who served the Lord with their shy, affectionate glances and laughter. Lord Hari is the ultimate cause of universal creation, maintenance, and destruction. My dear King, anyone who chants about, hears about, or simply appreciates the extraordinary activities he performed in this world, which are impossible to imitate, will surely develop devotion for the Supreme Lord, the bestower of liberation. Chapter 70, Lord Krishna's Daily Activities. Shukadeva Goswami said, as dawn approached, the wives of Lord Madhava, each embraced around the neck by her husband, cursed the crowing roosters. The ladies were disturbed that now they would be separated from him. The bees buzzing, caused by the fragrant breeze from the Parijata garden, roused the birds from sleep. And when the birds began to sing loudly, they woke Lord Krishna like court poets reciting his glories. Lying in her beloved's arms, Queen Vaidarbhi did not like this most auspicious hour, for it meant that she would lose his embrace. Lord Madhava would rise during the Brahma Muhurta hour and touch water. With a clear mind, he would then meditate upon himself, the single, self-luminous, unequaled, and infallible supreme truth, known as Brahman, who by his very nature ever dispels all contamination, and who through his personal energies, which cause the creation and destruction of this universe, manifests his own pure and blissful existence. That most saintly of personalities would then bathe in sanctified water, dress himself in lower and upper garments, and perform the entire sequence of prescribed rituals, beginning with worship at dawn. After offering oblations into the sacred fire, Lord Krishna would silently chant the Gayatri Mantra. Each day the Lord worshipped the rising sun and propitiated the demigods, sages, and forefathers, who are all his expansions. The self-possessed Lord would then carefully worship his elders and the Brahmins. To those well-attired Brahmins, he would offer herds of tame and peaceful cows with gold-plated horns and pearl necklaces. These cows were also dressed in fine cloth, and the fronts of their hooves were plated with silver. Providers of abundant milk, they had each given birth only once and were accompanied by their calves. Daily, the Lord gave many groups of 13,084 cows to the learned Brahmins, together with linen, deer skins, and sesame seeds. Lord Krishna would offer obeisances to the cows, Brahmins, and demigods, his elders and spiritual masters, and all living beings. all of whom are expansions of his supreme personality. Then he would touch auspicious things. He would decorate his body, the very ornament of human society, with his own special clothes and jewelry, and with divine flower garlands and ointments. He would then look at ghee, a mirror, the cows and bulls, the Brahmins and the demigods, and see to it that the members of all the social classes living in the palace and throughout the city were satisfied with gifts. After this, he would greet his ministers, gratifying them by fulfilling all their desires. After first distributing flower garlands, pan, and sandalwood paste to the Brahmins, he would give these gifts to his friends, ministers, and wives, and finally he would partake of them himself. By then the Lord's driver would have brought his supremely wonderful chariot, yoked with Sugriva and his other horses. His charioteer would bow down to the Lord and then stand before him. Holding on to his charioteer's hands, Lord Krishna would mount the chariot, together with Satyaki and Uddhava, just like the sun rising over the easternmost mountain. The palace women would look upon Lord Krishna with shy, loving glances, and thus he would get free from them only with difficulty. He would then set off, his smiling face captivating their minds. The Lord, attended by all the Vishnis, would enter the Sudharma assembly hall, which protects those who enter it from the six waves of material life. As the Almighty Supreme Lord would seat himself upon his exalted throne there in the assembly hall, he shone with his unique effulgence, illuminating all the quarters of space. Surrounded by the Yadus, lions among men, that best of the Yadus appeared like the moon amidst many stars. And there, O King, jesters would entertain the Lord by displaying various comic moods, expert entertainers would perform for him, and female dancers would dance energetically. These performers would dance and sing to the sounds of mridangas, veenas, murujas, flutes, cymbals, and conch shells, while professional poets, chroniclers, and panegyrists would recite the Lord's glories. Some Brahmins sitting in that assembly hall would fluently chant Vedic mantras, while others recounted stories of past kings of pious renown. Once a certain person arrived in the assembly who had never been seen there before. The doorkeepers announced him to the Lord and then escorted him inside. That person bowed down to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and with joined palms he described to the Lord how a number of kings were suffering because Jarasandh had imprisoned them. 20,000 kings who had refused to submit absolutely to Jarasandh during his world conquest had been forcibly imprisoned by him in the fortress named Girivraja. The king said, as related through their messenger, "O Krishna, Krishna, O immeasurable soul, destroyer of fear for those surrendered to you, despite our separatist attitude, we have come to you for shelter out of fear of material existence. People in this world are always engaged in sinful activities and are thus bewildered about their real duty, which is to worship you according to your commandments. This activity would truly bring them good fortune. Let us offer our obeisances unto the all-powerful Lord, who appears as time and suddenly cuts down one's stubborn hope for a long life in this world. You are the predominating Lord of the universe and have descended into this world with your personal power to protect the saintly and suppress the wicked. We cannot understand, O Lord, how anyone can transgress your law and still continue to enjoy the fruits of his work. O Lord, with this corpse-like body, always full of fear, we bear the burden of the relative happiness of kings, which is just like a dream. Thus we have rejected the real happiness of the soul, which comes by rendering selfless service to you. Being so very wretched, we simply suffer in this life under the spell of your illusory energy. Therefore, since your feet relieve the sorrow of those who surrender to them, please release us prisoners from the shackles of karma, manifest as the king of Magadha. Wielding alone the prowess of 10,000 maddened elephants, he has locked us up in his house just as a lion captures sheep. O wielder of the disc, your strength is unlimited, and thus 17 times you crushed Jarasandh in battle. But then, absorbed in human affairs, you allowed him to defeat you once. Now he is so filled with pride that he dares to torment us, your subjects. O unconquerable one, please rectify this situation." The messenger continued, "This is the message of the kings imprisoned by Jarasandh, who all hanker for your audience, having surrendered to your feet. Please bestow good fortune on these poor souls." Shukadev Goswami said, "When the king's messenger had thus spoken, the sage of the demigods, Narada, suddenly appeared. Bearing a mass of golden matted locks on his head, the supremely effulgent sage entered like the brilliant sun. Lord Krishna is the worshipable master of even planetary rulers like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. Yet as soon as he saw that Narada Muni had arrived, he joyfully stood up along with his ministers and secretaries to receive the great sage and offer his respectful obeisances by bowing his head. After Narada had accepted the seat offered to him, Lord Krishna honored the sage according to scriptural injunctions and, gratifying him with his reverence, spoke the following truthful and pleasing words. It is certain that today the three worlds have attained freedom from all fear, for that is the influence of such a great personality as you, who travel at will throughout all the worlds. There is nothing unknown to you within God's creation. Therefore, please tell us what the Pandavas intend to do. Sri Narada said, I have seen many times the insurmountable power of your Maya, O Almighty One, by which you bewilder even the creator of the universe, Brahma. O all-encompassing Lord, it does not surprise me that you disguise yourself by your own energies while moving among the created beings, as a fire covers its own light with smoke. Who can properly understand your purpose? With your material energy you expand and also withdraw this creation, which thus appears to have substantial existence. Obeisances to you, whose transcendental position is inconceivable. The living being caught in the cycle of birth and death does not know how he can be delivered from the material body, which brings him so much trouble. But you, the Supreme Lord, descend to this world in various personal forms, and by performing your pastimes, you illumine the soul's path with the blazing torch of your fame. Therefore, I surrender unto you. Nonetheless, O Supreme Truth, playing the part of a human being, I shall tell you what your devotee Yudhisthira Maharaj, the son of your father's sister, intends to do. Desiring unrivaled sovereignty, King Yudhisthira intends to worship you with the greatest fire sacrifice, the Rajasuya. Please bless his endeavor. O Lord, exalted demigods and glorious kings, eager to see you, will all come to that best of sacrifices. O Lord, even outcasts are purified by hearing and chanting your glories and meditating upon you, the absolute truth. What then to speak of those who see and touch you? My dear Lord, you are the symbol of everything auspicious. Your transcendental name and fame is spread like a canopy all over the universe, including the higher, middle, and lower planetary systems. The transcendental water that washes your lotus feet is known in the higher planetary systems as the Mandakini River, in the lower planetary systems as the Bhogavati, and in this earthly planetary system as the Ganges. This sacred transcendental water flows throughout the entire universe, purifying wherever it goes. Shukadev Goswami said, when his supporters, the Yadavas, objected to this proposal out of eagerness to defeat Jarasandh, Lord Keshava turned to his servant Uddhava and, smiling, addressed him with fine words. You are indeed our best eye and closest friend, for you know perfectly the relative value of various kinds of counsel. Therefore, please tell us what should be done in this situation. We trust your judgment and shall do as you say. Shukadev Goswami continued, thus requested by his master, who, though omniscient, acted as if perplexed, Uddhava took this order upon his head and replied as follows. Chapter 71. The Lord Travels to Indraprastha. Shukadev Goswami said, having thus heard the statements of Devarshi Narada, and understanding the opinions of both the assembly and Lord Krishna, the great-minded Uddhava began to speak. O Lord, as the sage advised, you should help your cousin fulfill his plan for performing the Rajasuya sacrifice, and you should also protect the kings who are begging for your shelter. Only one who has conquered all opponents in every direction can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, O Almighty One. Thus, in my opinion, conquering Jarasandh will serve both purposes. By this decision, there will be great gain for us, and you will save the kings. Thus, Govinda, you will be glorified. The invincible King Jarasandh is as strong as 10,000 elephants. Indeed, other powerful warriors cannot defeat him. Only Bhima is equal to him in strength. He will be defeated in a match of single chariots, not when he is with his 100 military divisions. Now, Jarasandh is so devoted to Brahminical culture that he never refuses requests from Brahmins. Bhima should go to him disguised as a Brahmin and beg charity. Thus he will obtain single combat with Jarasandh and in your presence, Bhima will no doubt kill him. Even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva act only as your instruments in cosmic creation and annihilation, which are ultimately done by you, the Supreme Lord, in your invisible aspect of time. In their homes, the godly wives of the imprisoned kings sing of your noble deeds, about how you will kill their husband's enemy and deliver them. The gopis also sing your glories, how you killed the enemy of the elephant king, Gajendra, the enemy of Sita, daughter of Janaka, and the enemies of your own parents as well. So also do the sages who have obtained your shelter glorify you, as do we ourselves. O Krishna, the killing of Jarasandha, which is certainly a reaction of his past sins, will bring immense benefit. Indeed, it will make possible the sacrificial ceremony you desire. Shukadeva Goswami said, O King, Devarshi Narada, the Yadu elders, and Lord Krishna all welcomed Uddhava's proposal, which was entirely auspicious and infallible. The Almighty Personality of Godhead, the son of Devaki, begged his superiors for permission to leave. Then he ordered his servants, headed by Daruka and Jaitra, to prepare for departure. After he had arranged for the departure of his wives, children, and baggage, and taken leave of Lord Sankarshan and King Ugrasen, Lord Krishna mounted his chariot, which had been brought by his driver. It flew a flag marked with the emblem of Garuda. As the vibrations resounding from mridangas, berries, kettle drums, conch shells, and gomukhas filled the sky in all directions, Lord Krishna set out on his journey. He was accompanied by the chief officers of his corps of chariots, elephants, infantry, and cavalry, and surrounded on all sides by his fierce personal guard. Lord Achyuta's faithful wives, along with their children, followed the Lord on golden palanquins carried by powerful men. The queens were adorned with fine clothing, ornaments, fragrant oils, and flower garlands, and they were surrounded on all sides by soldiers carrying swords and shields in their hands. On all sides proceeded finely adorned women, attendants of the royal household, as well as courtesans. They rode on palanquins and camels, bulls and buffalo, donkeys, mules, bullock carts, and elephants. Their conveyances were fully loaded with grass tents, blankets, clothes, and other items for the trip. The Lord's army boasted royal umbrellas, chamara fans, and huge flagpoles with waving banners. During the day, the sun's rays reflected brightly from the soldiers' fine weapons, jewelry, helmets, and armor. Thus, Lord Krishna's army, noisy with shouts and clatter, appeared like an ocean stirring with agitated waves and timangila fish. Honored by Sri Krishna, the chief of the Yadus, Narada Muni bowed down to the Lord. All of Narada's senses were satisfied by his meeting with Lord Krishna. Thus, having heard the decision of the Lord and having been worshipped by him, Narada placed him firmly within his heart and departed through the sky. With pleasing words, the Lord addressed the messenger sent by the kings. My dear messenger, I wish all good fortune for you. I shall arrange for the killing of King Magadha. Do not fear. Thus addressed, the messenger departed and accurately relayed the Lord's message to the kings. Eager for freedom, they then waited expectantly for their meeting with Lord Krishna. As he traveled through the provinces of Anarta, Sauvira, Marudesh, and Vinashan, Lord Hari crossed rivers and passed mountains, cities, villages, cow pastures, and quarries. After crossing the rivers Drishtavati and Saraswati, he passed through Panchala and Matsya, and finally came to Indraprastha. King Yudhishthira was delighted to hear that the Lord, whom human beings rarely see, had now arrived. Accompanied by his priests and dear associates, the king came out to meet Lord Krishna. As songs and musical instruments resounded along with the loud vibration of Vedic hymns, the king went forth with great reverence to meet Lord Rishikesh, just as the senses go forth to meet the consciousness of life. The heart of King Yudhishthira melted with affection when he saw his dearmost friend, Lord Krishna, after such a long separation, and he embraced the Lord again and again. The eternal form of Lord Krishna is the everlasting residence of the Goddess of Fortune. As soon as King Yudhishthira embraced him, the king became free of all the contamination of material existence. He immediately felt transcendental bliss and merged in an ocean of happiness. There were tears in his eyes, and his body shook due to ecstasy. He completely forgot that he was living in this material world. Then Bhima, his eyes brimming with tears, laughed with joy as he embraced his maternal cousin, Krishna. Arjun and the twins, Nakula and Sahadev, also joyfully embraced their dearmost friend, the infallible Lord, and they cried profusely. After Arjuna had embraced him once more, and Nakula and Sahadev had offered him their obeisances, Lord Krishna bowed down to the Brahmins and elders present, thus properly honoring the respectable members of the Kuru, Srinjaya, and Kaikeya clans. Sutas, Magadas, Gandharvas, Vandis, jesters, and Brahmins all glorified the lotus-eyed Lord, some reciting prayers, some dancing and singing, as mridangas, conch shells, kettle drums, veenas, panavas, and gomukhas resounded. Thus surrounded by his well-wishing relatives and praised on all sides, Lord Krishna, the crest jewel of the justly renowned, entered the decorated city. The roads of Indraprastha were sprinkled with water perfumed by the liquid from elephants' foreheads, and colorful flags, golden gateways, and full water pots enhanced the city's splendor. Men and young girls were beautifully arrayed in fine new garments, adorned with flower garlands and ornaments, and anointed with aromatic sandalwood paste. Every home displayed glowing lamps and respectful offerings, and from the holes of the latticed windows drifted incense, further beautifying the city. Banners waved, and the roofs were decorated with golden domes on broad silver bases. Thus Lord Krishna saw the royal city of the king of the Kurus. When the young women of the city heard that Lord Krishna, the reservoir of pleasure for human eyes, had arrived, they hurriedly went onto the royal road to see him. They abandoned their household duties and even left their husbands in bed, and in their eagerness the knots of their hair and garments came loose. The royal road being quite crowded with elephants, horses, chariots, and foot soldiers, the women climbed to the top of their houses, where they caught sight of Lord Krishna and his queens. The city ladies scattered flowers upon the Lord, embraced him in their minds, and expressed their heartfelt welcome with broadly smiling glances. In various places, citizens of the city came forward holding auspicious offerings for Lord Krishna, and sinless leaders of occupational guilds came forward to worship the Lord. With wide open eyes, the members of the royal household came forward in a flurry to lovingly greet Lord Mukunda, and thus the Lord entered the royal palace. When Queen Prita saw her nephew Krishna, the master of the three worlds, her heart became filled with love. Rising from her couch with her daughter-in-law, she embraced the Lord. King Yudhishthir respectfully brought Lord Govinda, the supreme god of gods, to his personal quarters. The king was so overcome with joy that he could not remember all the rituals of worship. Lord Krishna bowed down to his aunt and the wives of his elders, and then Draupadi and the Lord's sister bowed down to him. Encouraged by her mother-in-law, Draupadi worshipped all of Lord Krishna's wives, including Rukmini, Satyabhama, Bhadra, Jambavati, Kalindi, Mitravinda, the descendant of Shibi, the chaste Nagmajati, and the other queens of the Lord who were present. Draupadi honored them all with such gifts as clothing, flower garlands, and jewelry. King Yudhishthir arranged for Krishna's rest and saw to it that all who came along with him, namely his queens, soldiers, ministers, and secretaries, were comfortably situated. He arranged that they would experience a new feature of reception every day while staying as guests of the Pandavas. Desiring to please King Yudhishthir, the Lord resided at Indraprastha for several months. During his stay, he and Arjun satisfied the fire god by offering him the Kandava forest, and they saved Mayadhanava, who then built King Yudhishthir's celestial assembly hall. The Lord also took the opportunity to go riding in his chariot in the company of Arjun, surrounded by a retinue of soldiers. Chapter 72, The Slaying of the Demon Jarasandh. Shukadev Goswami said, "One day, as King Yudhishthir sat in the royal assembly surrounded by eminent sages, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, and also by his brothers, spiritual masters, family elders, blood relations, in-laws, and friends, he addressed Lord Krishna as everyone listened. O Govinda, I desire to worship your auspicious opulent expansions by the Rajasuya sacrifice, the king of Vedic ceremonies. Please make our endeavor a success, my lord." Purified persons who constantly serve, meditate upon, and glorify your shoes, which destroy everything inauspicious, are sure to obtain freedom from material existence, O lotus-navelled one. Even if they desire something in this world, they obtain it, whereas others, those who do not take shelter of you, are never satisfied. Therefore, O Lord of Lords, let the people of this world see the power of devotional service rendered to your lotus feet. Please show them, O Almighty One, the position of those Kurus and Srinjayas who worship you, and the position of those who do not.